In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In this second hour, we continue the discussion with Patrick Kelly. He's the author of the massive ebook titled The Practical Guide to Free Energy Devices. We've reviewed some of the free energy device categories outlined in the ebook. We'll also talk about passive or etheric energy related to orgone and pyramid structures. Patrick had mentioned that he had been informed by an insider that there are more than 40,000 suppressed free energy patents in the United States alone. How will human society break free of this suppression? We go now into the second hour of the interview with retired civil engineer Patrick Kelly. Welcome back to Another News for the second hour of the interview.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We left off talking about a device, a free energy device, that could increase the efficiency of a vehicle. And I'd like to continue to talk about this area of free energy device inventions. There's something called the Joe cell. Could you elaborate on that and the related suppression?
Yes, certainly. In 1992 in Australia, three men, Graham Coe, Peter Stevens, and Joe Noble, developed a previously patented device which has now become known by the name of the Joe cell, because it was Joe Noble who built the replication and developed it further. Peter introduced Joe to Graham, and they went through the patent, and they used materials from the local dairy production facility, Norco. They produced a cell which is capable of running an engine without any fuel at all. What it is doing is it's concentrating and focusing some of the zero-point energy field directly into the engine itself. It doesn't have to be connected to the carburetor. You don't actually need a carburetor. You don't need any form of fuel. The energy from the cell can be fed through an aluminium pipe, finishing up with about an inch of plastic pipe to insulate it electrically from the engine block. And you can attach it to any point you like on the engine block, such as a bolt head or something like that. They did a two-hour video where the initial cell was attached to the Mitsubishi van belonging to Peter Stevens. And it was a very popular video. It may still be around, I'm not sure. But though a lot of opposition resulted from that. Joe had his equipment stolen, his dog was killed, and he decided then he would keep a low profile, and he moved out into the bush and decided not to generate very much publicity. It's quite a difficult thing to, or at least when they did it, it was quite a difficult thing to actually produce and make. Nowadays, David Lawrence has managed to understand the technology behind it, and he's defined measurements, exact measurements, which can be used when you're actually making the cell as such. The cell is comprised of a series of stainless steel cylinders, one which is placed inside the other. There are five or six cylinders, depending on which style you want to make. And the system is very effective as such. One of these was built by an American guy called Bill Williams, and he attached it to his Ford pickup truck, and he found that the performance of the pickup truck was phenomenal. He described it like being driving a Ferrari racing car.
Wow.
He was having trouble in getting it to operate smoothly, because when you push the throttle, it would tend to go from 30 miles an hour to 80 miles an hour almost immediately. And that's not a great idea when you're driving around town. So he stopped off in a lay-by to adjust the system a bit to see if he could get it running more smoothly. Incidentally, in passing, the reason why he was doing that was he had an air leak in the connecting pipe. That was what was making it a bit unpredictable in operation. But he was just starting to adjust it when an SUV pulled into the lay-by just ahead of him, and he was approached by two thugs who were armed. They gave him a dossier which is 2 inches thick, showing pictures and photographs of his children, a schedule of where they were at each time of each day, and they told him that if he didn't destroy his cell and stop talking about it, that they would harm his family. It took a while, but Bill has now actually, for the safety of his family, stopped talking about it. But the timing didn't work out very well for them, because the day before that happened, I emailed him and asked him for permission to publish the engineering drawings that he had made on how he built his Joe cell. And he said there was no problem, I was welcome to publish them. So as soon as I heard what had happened, I spread it out, and within a couple of hours there would have been about 10,000 copies scattered around the world. And when that happened, there's absolutely no advantage in harming his family, because all it would do is reinforce the fact that they wanted to stop it, and that would make it very much more viable in the eyes of the average person. But the actual publication of his plans are there, and are still there, in Chapter 9 of my ebook. But it has been advanced considerably since then. David Lawrence, who is a sensitive, has managed to deduce how the Joe cell operates. And because of that, he's able to give specific dimensions so that you can actually make these particular cylindrical inserts for your unit to an exact size. And if you are making them and from a sheet of stainless steel, then you want to align the joins so that they're all exactly lined up. But all the details are there, all the dimensions are there, and it is perfectly possible to produce a cell which will allow an engine to run continuously. Actually, one of the problems that Joe Noble found was he had great difficulty in stopping an engine that was running on a Joe cell, because how do you actually stop it? It's not the easiest thing to do. And there are times when you do want to turn off the engine of a vehicle. But that aside, the Joe cell is a very effective method nowadays of powering pretty much any engine you want. And there's nothing to stop it being a stationary engine, which is driving a big generator. So it's one of the ways, potentially, of how you could produce serious amounts of electricity for one or more houses.
Right. Excellent. Yes. This is in your ebook in Chapter 9. Have you figured out how this works?
Only in broad outline. I can merely say that it is something that is tuned to one of the frequencies of the zero-point energy field and will cause a flow of energy continuously through the cell. And that flow of energy is perfectly capable of running an engine. There are a number of shapes that will affect the zero-point energy field. The most commonly known of those is a pyramid shape, and ideally to the exact slope dimensions of the Great Pyramid in Giza in Egypt. What happens is that you get a flow of energy along the corner edges of the pyramid itself, and also up through the center of the pyramid. And a key point is about a third of the way up from the base, exactly underneath the peak of the pyramid itself. Thomas Trawoger, a German guy, has got details of how he built a detector which he positioned into one of these home-built, small, like 3 feet across the base units. and he managed to draw off enough electricity from that to power a fan. But not surprisingly, he was attacked left, right, and center when he showed this on a forum, because there was a lot of opposition to having free energy devices that don't need any form of input energy at all. But the details of all that are also in Chapter 9. Chapter 9 is specifically for passive devices, devices where you don't supply any energy at all. Now, one of the people who built a large version pyramid, an experimenter who decided that he would have experimentation on crop growing and other things, I think his pyramid was about 15 feet tall, something of that order. And he decided that he would connect the peak of the pyramid to an earthing point just underneath it, and he would use wool as a natural material to actually make the connection. Well, he attempted to make the connection, and the result was he got such a jolt of energy that it threw him about 20 feet across the pyramid itself. He didn't do that again, and he didn't try implementing it again. But there is a lot of energy in a big pyramid. It depends on how you orientate it, and it depends on how you build it. One of the ways of very effectively doing it is a bit expensive. You make the sides of steel, but you plate the outside of the steel sides with gold, which makes it expensive. But that has a very, very marked effect. And you can get enormous effects from a pyramid. I know it sounds a bit nutty, but these are the facts. If you build even a small pyramid and, for instance, put some food underneath it in the middle, you will get insects. You do this outdoors. You will get insects wanting to get to the food, and they will come into the pyramid, but they won't get across to the food. They will stop and turn around and go away. And if, for instance, you were to make a fairly large one and keep animals inside it, it has an enormous effect on the animals. I mean, it's been known on occasions for a dog which was getting too old to survive and getting in very poor health to be put inside one of these pyramids for a couple of days, and it completely rejuvenated the animal. It came back out like a much younger dog in good health. But these are weird-sounding things that I really don't want to get into.
I was going to ask you, Patrick.
Because I'm much more geared up to be an engineering aspect of how you physically make a device that will give you power that you can use in your house and in your life.
I understand your reluctance getting into this area because it's dealing with the ether, and also it's highly ridiculed by those people sitting on the sidelines of life criticizing others who take a chance, start to do things. However, Albert Einstein had mentioned that the ether exists. In fact, it's in that documentary, that Tesla Zero Point documentary, where he says the zero point energy would not exist without the ether. And I think that's related to this particular type of energy that you're speaking of regarding pyramids, and also Wilhelm Reich's work with orgone energy and orgonite. We don't have to get into that, but going back to what you were describing with the Joe cell, and it is a good example of free energy devices that can provide power and torque to run large vehicles, which I think is really important because that's one of the excuses that I've heard before, that free energy devices don't have that kind of power and torque to drive big machinery.
Yes, there's something I should probably clarify, and that is that the zero-point energy field is also called the ether. It's also called the vacuum, V-A-C-U-U-M-E. It's sometimes referred to as orgone as well. Just different names for the same thing. It's the energy field that powers everything. And the Joe cell taps into this energy field, and it doesn't matter what you call it. And this is something that was very well recognized before Albert Einstein was even born. So it's got nothing whatsoever to do with him, thankfully. Like I say, I don't think anything that Albert Einstein ever said or did was actually true. Well, the only thing that he said eventually that was true was that there was an ether, but everybody knew that to begin with. For instance, relativity is completely incorrect in all versions. It just isn't true. But, for instance, his most famous, the thing that he's most famous for is the equation E equals mc squared. Energy is equal to mass times a very large number indeed. Now, that equation is not from Albert Einstein. That equation was produced by Oliver Heaviside decades before Albert Einstein ever said anything about it. What I will say is that Einstein did make it famous, but he didn't mention the fact that it wasn't his. Or at least if he did, nobody seemed to notice the fact. But almost nothing that Albert Einstein ever said is useful from the point of view of zero-point energy. For instance, it's often said that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. That, unfortunately, is not true. It's been proven in the laboratory in small scale, but there are two sides to every coin. There are things that travel below the speed of light, and the things that travel above the speed of light. There is a famous physics problem, which is action at a distance, where two particles that are associated, no matter how far apart they are, one will react immediately to anything that happens to the other one. The reason for that is that they're embedded in the background of the universe, which is the universal medium that everything lives in. And everything in that medium is way faster than light. In fact, it's so fast you can take it as instantaneous everywhere. There is no such thing as a speed limit on of light. Incidentally, the speed of light is not a constant. It varies considerably. A lot of the ideas about the universe, that it's expanding or contracting or whatever, are deduced from observations made of light. They say light has traveled so far and it's become redder, so we know that X, Y, Z. That isn't the case in actual fact, because we don't know what happens to light as it spends a long time traveling. So quite honestly, most of this stuff is completely erroneous. One of the things that's pointed out by Joseph Cater, who was a very sensible gentleman, is that the measurements of the heights of mountains is almost invariably wrong. You take an altimeter and go drive up a mountain where there are towns all the way up the mountain, you will find that the measurements given on maps for the towns is completely correct until you get to the top. And then at the top, it's completely wrong, because light is affected when it comes near the top of a mountain. But people use triangulation to deduce how high a mountain actually is. How tall is it? What is the maximum height of the mountain itself? So we're actually surrounded by a lot of erroneous information. Assumptions that are made left, right, and center that are completely wrong. For instance, the Encyclopedia Britannica had one edition whereby it specified the gravity of the moon and where the balance point would be between the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the Moon. And in a later edition, they had a difference of something like 3.5 times for that distance. They didn't say anything about it, but the reason was that they discovered that the assumptions about gravity of the Moon were completely wrong. We're completely surrounded by all sorts of silly information, most of which is completely wrong, but nobody tends to pay any attention to. But I'm getting off subject here. Sorry for that.
Let's keep going here. I did want to add in A couple of things about the pyramid energy that you mentioned. There's a woman out in Michigan that was mentioned on a past show who built a, I think it was about a 50-foot pyramid that she built the pyramid. Afterward, this is what was explained to me by the past guest. The Navy had visited her, and they were inquiring about this, which implies that it came up on their radar. So I thought that was interesting, that etheric energy caused by the pyramid was enough to bring in, you know, the military to examine what was going on here and to talk to the owner. But they disguised themselves as encyclopedia salesmen.
Yes, that's a very big pyramid indeed. And yes, it does have a considerable effect. What you need to understand is that the New World Order people are in advance of our technology by anything from 100 to 1,000 years. Every single thing shown on Star Trek has been physically implemented by them. They have had what you would call UFO, saucer-shaped, anti-gravitic vehicles for, at least 50 years now. I'm not saying that all of them are human-made, but certainly it's routine for the American Black Ops people to use flying saucers. It's also not secret to just America. I mean, Canada, Britain, and Russia also are in on that. And some of the constructions are joint between Russia and America and have been for decades now at this stage. But this is a technology that they cannot afford to let out. Because if you think about it, if your average person has got an anti-gravitic or electro-gravitic vehicle, which allows them to travel at tens of thousands of miles an hour and doesn't need fuel and is vertical takeoff and vertical landing, that means that the borders of countries become totally ineffective. You cannot stop people entering your country when they can enter anywhere at high speed, anytime, and land anywhere. So from the point of view of political people, this is something that cannot be allowed to happen. You must not allow ordinary people to have an electrogravitic drive. And electrogravitic drive is 10 to the power 39 times more powerful than gravity. So, you know, you're talking about very little power being needed to shunt your flying vehicle out into the far ends of the solar system. I mean, this is something that you can do in a few minutes. But that sort of thing has been around for a long time. I mean, Tesla produced a design for that and actually flew it. It doesn't have to be circular. I think his was actually square, but I'm not sure. I wasn't around then.
Well, there are often reports of large rectangular train boxcar-shaped UFOs. I hear reports of those quite often.
I'd never heard of rectangular-shaped vehicles. I've heard of triangular, and I've heard of cigar-shaped, and I've heard of generally circular in plan view type flying vehicles. But there's no reason why it shouldn't be any particular shape you want.
There is the boxcar-shaped. There's the flat football field-size rectangular UFO that's often reported moving low above treetops. Another question I had for you, this is in the way out category here, since we're here, and you mentioned Star Trek technology, so there's the transporter technology, and I wondered about that and your understanding if that could exist right now and be in use.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of some of these shapes that you mentioned, but I have been aware of reports where some of the flying objects have been 6 miles across, and that's quite some size of flying machine. But size is not particularly important if you're producing a gravitational field which acts on all points of the vehicle itself at the same time. But transporter technology has definitely been produced and implemented. It's been done as part of the black ops of the New World people, New World Order people, in their development. Joseph Kater has observed quite a number of very important things. And one of them is that the way that gravity is assessed is completely wrong, and that pretty much all planets will have a gravitational field big enough to have an atmosphere, and that the moon certainly has an atmosphere, even though it's difficult to detect as such. And he points out some of the comments by the astronauts going there, which demonstrate the fact that there is an atmosphere there. But in, for instance, Mars, there is not only an atmosphere, but there is a development place that the New World Order people are running there. And they, I'm told, have got a transporter that will go straight from Earth directly to the Martian depot. I don't know whether it needs a receiver platform at the far end. I really don't know. They don't, obviously, say much about it ever to anyone, because this is super, super secret. But this is something that I'm pretty certain is correct. But I'm not sure that it's something that we necessarily need to concern ourselves with. But just from the point of view that these people who have been acquiring and stealing the designs and information from very intelligent and advanced inventors for many, many decades now, they have been using that in their own developments, and this is why they're so far ahead of everything that is conventional science technology at the moment. I mean, where we're at the moment is ridiculous compared to where we really should be at. But this is the way that the system is being run at the moment. And in some ways, you can understand why they do what they're doing. Some of the things would not be advisable for them to let out to public.
Where should we be at right now, Patrick?
We should definitely be in the situation where everybody has a home generator for free electricity. Now, that in turn allows you to produce unlimited quantities of water for desert areas, and you can then irrigate and make productive all desert areas. You can do desalination, or you could take moisture from the air. Either perfectly viable for making the deserts productive and pleasant again. You also have the ability to produce food. Now, one of the things that I've been told is that everything in Star Trek has been replicated, which means that you can take power from the zero-point energy field and actually synthesize food. So there would be no hunger or famine as such.
I wanted to ask you about your work with specific inventors that you've been in touch with. Can you tell listeners about the process that you go through to contact the inventors and get the information for your ebook?
Well, with the exception of Dave Lawton, who had put his Stanley Mayer replication cell into his spares box before I discovered it when I was chatting to him on the phone, typically it's a case of inventors contact me and invite me to publicize their work. Now, the trouble is that an inventor has thought about his particular invention typically for years. And whereas he struggled with the concepts early on, he then has become so familiar with the concepts and how the thing works and why it works and how to tune it up and how to make it run properly, that he has forgotten that most people don't know that. And your typical inventor has got two major attributes. One is that he thinks his invention is very simple and very straightforward. And the other thing is that he's almost totally incapable of expressing himself. I mean, clear explanation and the quality of being an inventor tend never to go hand in hand. So generally speaking, I ask the guy to tell me about his invention, what it is and how it works. It takes five goes to get a clear, descriptive write-up on any particular invention from any particular inventor. But eventually, we reach the point where the inventor reads what I've written down and says, yeah, that's right. And what I've written down is something that your ordinary average person can generally understand. And that's what gets published. It doesn't always get published by me. Sometimes I write it for the inventor, and my name doesn't appear. Hmm. And the inventor then puts it out as his description of his invention, which is fine. I'm not interested in promoting Patrick Kelly, not at all, in any respect. What I'm trying to do is oppose the clampdown on information that's been imposed on us, and to tell people about the realities that are there as such. And in passing, that does tend to lead me into explaining the financial cons that have been run against us, and explaining how particular inventors are being suppressed. But it's really just a case of sharing what I have researched myself. I have built some of the things. For instance, a very simple device known as the Fleet device, which is coils of wire on top of a plastic former driven by one transistor and one resistor. I've used that to charge a 12-volt lead-acid battery, a little one, of 1.3 amp-hour capacity, using an identical battery, which wasn't fully charged when I started. Then you swap the batteries over and do it again. I've done that several times, and the result is that both batteries end up with more usable, genuine energy in it than they started out with. Now, according to conventional science, that is completely impossible, especially since lead-acid batteries are only 50% efficient. In other words, you have to put twice as much into them as you're ever going to get back out of them. So this very simple build-in-an-evening device has proven free energy to me without any question. I mean, if you can use one battery to charge another and then vice versa, and they both end up with genuine power, then you've gained a lot in the way of energy, especially since you have to produce more than twice the charging energy than you have on the discharging energy. So from that point of view, it's very interesting. If you're using lead-acid batteries, though, you need to be careful, because there is a chemical effect that continues on after you stop charging a battery. So you need to leave it sit for about an hour before you can actually measure the real voltage. And the only way that you can be sure that you're not getting surface charge in the battery is to run a load from it. But doing that, we can see quite clearly that even something as simple as the Fleet unit, which is a version of the Joule Thief, is something that definitely draws energy from the surrounding environment and pumps it into your battery. So from that point of view, quite simple things, even made by somebody like myself who has very, very limited constructional ability, can show without question that there is such a thing as free energy.
Patrick, you're one of very few people that I know that can actually talk about specific incidences where individual inventors were threatened or harmed or poisoned, murdered in some way for creating free energy devices and trying to get it out to people. Can we go down a short list of these inventors and their story?
All right. Let's start with people that I know personally. There's a mechanical engineer with his own workshop and business in India called Ravi Raju, and he produced a replication of Dave Lawton's hydrogen fuel cell, what Stan Mayer called a water fuel cell. And he was doing experiments on this, and he was publishing on YouTube videos of where he got to and what his measurements were and so on. And he was raided one day by five carloads of thugs who took his papers, took his materials, took some tools, took his cell, and told him to stop talking about these things. It was actually quite funny, as it happened, because he had just decided that he'd done as much as he wanted to do with the hydrogen cell, and he was going to move on to deal with magnetic devices. But this is an instance whereby inventors or developers or experimenters are harassed to a very considerable degree. They claimed that they were from the VAT office. He talked to the VAT office afterwards, and they said that they knew nothing whatsoever about any of these people, that they were nothing whatsoever to do with the VAT office, the value-added tax office, the general taxation. So that's one instance of somebody that I know. Another person I've met is Bob Boyce in America. Bob is expert in doing hydrogen devices and electrolysis of water and other things. In fact, one of the driving mechanisms that Bob Boyce produced has been used by a guy in South Africa to self-charge a battery. The battery powers Bob's circuit, and the circuit actually charges the battery that's driving it. And this guy has got a little daughter, and his little daughter has a car driven on a car battery. And during the day, she'd drive around in this thing and have fun. And at night time, her father would attach this charger to the battery itself. And it would recharge the battery overnight, ready for the next day, which is pretty interesting because in theory, that's impossible. But in practice, he's done it more than 30 times. But Bob had a design which was very popular with 100 flat plates creating a very large amount of HHO gas, typically 100 liters per minute maximum, 50 liters per minute being a constant. The difference being that it's difficult with 100 liters a second to actually stop the splashing caused by the bubbles coming out of the liquid. It's quite difficult to stop that getting out into the gas output because the gas flow is quite high. So it's quite difficult to actually get a baffling system which will stop the droplets but let the gas go through at high speed. But Bob was in developing his system in his workshop behind his house, and he was running the engine of a car in his workshop on this HHO gas when he was approached by the cops. The cops said that he was due to have a 3.5-year-long jail sentence for running a vehicle on an unapproved fuel, which is, of course, rubbish. But anyway, this was the excuse that they were using. But Bob went to court and managed to beat the charge there in court, which a lot of people wouldn't have done. But it was ridiculous. I mean, he was doing it in his workshop behind his house. He wasn't on a public road, and there's no reason at all why he shouldn't run his vehicle on HHO anyway. But that was one of the steps. Another step then was he was befriended by somebody who I would never have trusted, called Major Todd Hathaway of the U.S. military. And miraculously, Todd seemed to have lots of money, much more than you would expect of a major. And he funded Bob and bought him a car and so on for running tests on. But after a while, Todd brought a message from the U.S. military to Bob Boyce. And the message was that while he was allowed to produce boosters to improve miles per gallon performance on vehicles, he was not allowed to run a car on water alone. Now, that's something very interesting. First of all, it shows that the U.S. military is under the control of the New World Order. And it also shows that suppression of engineering and scientific information is completely rife in the United States. But what happened then was they then tried to discredit Bob. First of all, they got somebody to approach him and say, I'd like to manufacture booster cells to your design. Can we get together and make an arrangement?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that Bob went along with that, and he visited this other guy, also called Bob, surprisingly, and when he was there, he was drugged, and two radio frequency ID chips were embedded into his right shoulder when he was asleep. He wasn't aware of it.
Wow, they chipped
They
him.
Eventually went cancerous, and that's how he discovered them. And he had a doctor remove one of them. The doctor then refused point blank to admit that he'd taken it out of Bob's shoulder, but then discovered that there was a second one there. So he had that taken out, and he posted pictures of that online as what had been in his shoulder. These are devices that can be activated and respond back when they run into a radio frequency signal. These sort of signals are produced along the roads in America so that they keep track of people. The manufacturing process was deliberately messed up. Instead of preparing the plates in the electrolyzers as they needed to be, a different system was used, which guaranteed that the cell wouldn't work properly. So the objective was to try and persuade people that Bob Boyce didn't know what he was talking about, which, of course, Bob opposed vigorously on the web and got nowhere because people knew perfectly well that Bob Boyce was a real expert in this stuff. So that's the second one. We have the instance of Bill Williams in the States, who had been active on the Yahoo Watercar Forum for quite some time,
mm-hmm.
and was highly respected. He's produced various other designs since, which are pretty useful. But he, as you know, was intimidated for running a Joe cell as such. You've also mentioned Dave Lawton in Wales. Dave, very silly, applied for a grant from his local authorities for a development that he was doing. He never got it, of course, because they don't fund people who produce things that are useful. But shortly afterwards, he was visited by two CIA men in black, literally, well, except that one was a woman. Okay, a man and a woman in black, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
They are very clearly CIA, very taciturn, very grim, and they took away the various papers that Dave had prepared for applying for this grant, and they never returned them. So Dave got on to the local authority people and said, where are my papers? If you're not going to fund me, I want my papers back. And they said that they knew nothing whatsoever about these two people that visited him. They had no way of contacting them. But the papers were returned eventually, in spite of that, in spite of them not being able to contact them. But that is not directly suppression as such, but it shows very close supervision of anything involved by people who are competent. Take the case of Alan Caggiano in America. He produced a carburetor. Now, the efficiency of carburetors depends on converting the liquid fuel into a gas, or the worst, little tiny droplets suspended in air. Now, you get a great improvement in efficiency if you skip the droplets and turn the fuel into its gas state before you feed it into the engine. And Alan produced a system for that where he was getting 111 miles per gallon on his American car, which is pretty good, considering the American gallon is 20% less than the gallon elsewhere in the world. And this is something that he publicized. He painted on the car that he was doing this, that there was no pollution, he was getting a lot of MPG, and they put him in prison for some years. It's not unusual for people to get stuffed into prison because they're a pain in the neck as far as the establishment is concerned. So he eventually got out of prison, and he continued. You will find, if you want it, his design on my website. He had three or four different designs. But the same happened to most of the people with high MPG designs. There are more than 240 patents on high MPG carburetors. The way that the establishment fights back is they have got about 103 different additives that they use with petrol, gasoline in your case. And they add that to the gasoline for two reasons. One of them is they want to get rid of this rubbish that they're putting in the gasoline. And the other reason is that they will clog up any device that produces just vapor rather than the liquid into the car engine or the vehicle engine. So there are a lot of people like that who have a real problem. If we move to people who are well known, for instance, there is a guy called Floyd Sweet, who is closely associated with Tom Bearden. I sent you a video where the efficiency of Floyd's system was 150,000 times greater than one. In other words, it was 15,000,000% efficient. Mm-hmm. For an input of about a third of a milliwatt, he was getting more than 500 watts of electrical power out. And that's well documented. Now, they intimidated him by shooting at him, and when that eventually became ineffective and he went to go and get the thing manufactured, he met with a most unfortunate accident and died, I think, of lead poisoning from memory. You tend to die of lead poisoning if somebody shoots you. There's another person also was in a meeting with Tom Bearden. He'd Japanese guy called, if you pardon the pronunciation, Teru Kawai. He had a motor which is 160% efficient, and an electric motor. He wanted to run motorcycles and scooters on this particular motor.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd got a patent. The details are all in my ebook if you want them. And he was in a meeting with Tom Bearden when the room was entered by various thugs. He was taken away, and he was intimidated, and very successfully, he then refused to go any further with the deal. And so his motor, which is well known and very effective, was never produced. We also have the situation with John Bedini. John Bedini showed a system known as the Tesla switch, which he, in his instance, he built a copy into a small cigar box. He showed this at the Tesla Tech conference, I think it was in 1985. He'd had this running for 6 months solidly, self-powered. And shortly after the exhibition, he was approached by two armed thugs in his workshop. They smashed his Tesla switch. They shoved him up against a wall, shoved a gun in his face, and said he would buy gasoline for the rest of his life. Now, it's interesting. That was quite effective. John has got three devices. He's got the Tesla switch, which is high power, very impressive, but quite tricky to build. He's also got the pulsed flywheel, which is self-powered, very effective, very efficient. And he's got a battery pulsing system, which is fairly trivial. Its output is tiny. It could be made, if you put an awful lot of effort into it, it could be made into an effective system. But in the intervening years, what has John talked about? He's talked about the battery pulsing. He hasn't talked about the pulsed flywheel. He hasn't talked about the Tesla switch. Although in private, John describes the Tesla switch as pure gold.
Jeez.
It is my opinion that John is being heavily suppressed at the moment and forced to talk only about something which would be considered to be ineffective as such. Now, interestingly, there's a guy called Jim Wilson who took John Bedini's pulse flywheel design and built it very large. He built a unit that was 20 feet long and used an aircraft engine starter motor as part of the design. He showed that at the Tesla Tech Conference, and it was producing 12 kilowatts of excess energy. The interesting thing is, after he showed it in the conference, one of the batteries was stolen. The reason for that is that when you have a free energy device that has batteries as part of it, the batteries get charged up with negative energy, and it's quite easy to detect that it's negative energy. So that's why the battery was taken. It was taken to ensure that the device itself was definitely a free energy device, and there was no deception of any description in it. Shortly after the conference, both Jim Wilson and his device disappeared. Now, I don't think any harm came to Jim. He disappeared from his normal location. He never contacted any of his friends again, but people have bumped into him elsewhere and said that he looked very prosperous, but that he wouldn't talk to them. He just said goodbye and moved away immediately. So it seems almost certain that Jim was paid off. The odds are that he was given the option, which was quite common in those days, that either he would take a big payoff, go away, change his name, and stop talking about his design or what he built, or alternatively, if he didn't decide to do that within the next 5 minutes, both he and his family would be killed. That was quite a common technique, I understand, in those years. So he opted anyway, apparently, to get paid off and go away and stay quiet. Somebody else who operated along those lines is an American guy called Paul Zigouras. He was developing marine engines for his business, and he came up with a method for producing very effective electrolysis of water. His system was so effective that you could literally connect a hose to his little device and hose 15 gallons, U.S. gallons, of tap water through it. And the water would never get out the far end. All that came out the far end was gas. Easily enough to run one of his marine engines, which has more than 200 horsepower. But Paul was pretty strapped for cash, and he wanted to keep his business running. So he invited the opposition to actually buy him out for $6 million. And they did exactly that. Just ahead of them buying him out, he sold a unit on eBay, one of his early development units, for, I think it was $1,100.
Oh, wow.
And the people who bought him out for $6 million paid $5,000 to the purchaser to buy it back from him. But the interesting thing about Paul's system was all that he was doing was he was using a very high level of current, using lots of transistors in parallel to carry the current. And he arranged it also so that the voltage pulses applied to the cell never, ever went negative. They started off from a positive voltage, went higher and then back lower, down to a positive voltage always, which is a bit like the system used by Figura, Clement Figura, where he was powering his house from a car battery. But anyway, that is an interesting one. Paul never talks about his system anymore. Any facts that I've been able to gather about it are in Chapter 10 in the e-book. But then there are a lot of other people that you probably haven't come across as being targets of intimidation. One of them is Nikola Tesla. People tend to think that he was left pretty much alone and just not financed. That is not the case. He lived in a flat above his workshop. And at 2 a.m. one day, they torched the workshop. And the flames, of course, engulfed the flat above. As it happened, Nikola Tesla worked all hours, all days. And he had actually gone out for a meal during that 2 a.m. period. And he was very lucky to survive. He was very upset, I must remark, on the destruction of his laboratory and all the prototypes he had in it. but at least he walked away from that one. But I think most people are not aware of that fact. If that fire is reported, it will be reported as an accidental fire.
Patrick Kelly, I want to thank you for going down that list. You're very modest about your work, and you've been hassled, harassed, and intimidated. You mentioned that you had 6 different websites destroyed, and so you didn't have further access to fix the situation, and then your main email account was hacked as well. It's also happened to you. That's not surprising, because you're compiling essential information here for people to go to one place to find a lot out about free energy devices and their inventors. Your work is so important right now, and I really appreciate you being on the show to discuss this. Your ebook is called The Practical Guide to Free Energy Devices, and can you again please tell listeners where to find that on your website?
I'm only small fry by comparison, because I just talk about what other people have done. So any harassment that I've had has been very minor compared to them. I've merely had a lot of nuisance value operations against me. And one thing that you didn't mention is that when my email account was hacked, incoming emails were diverted and never reached me, and replies were sent back in my name, trying to put off the people who are emailing me, which is quite a powerful thing to do. As you say, the address of the website is www.free-energy-info.com.
Patrick Kelly, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.